Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, welcome everyone to this Federalist Society virtual event. As this afternoon, June 15th, 2021, we're discussing Closing the Digital Divide, the Future of Broadband Access. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on our call today are those of our experts. We're very glad to be joined this afternoon by two experts. We've got a moderator to lead the discussion and our future discussant. I'll leave the introducing to our moderator and just introduce him. We're very pleased to be joined this afternoon by Mr. Randolph May. He's the president of the Free State Foundation and a longstanding member of our Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, a sponsor of today's event. And before I give Randy the floor, just a quick note for our audience. We will be looking to you for questions throughout the call and especially towards the end. So please submit those via chat or the Q&A chat, and so Randy can filter those through and pick them out as he sees fit. So with that, Randy, thanks very much for being with us. I'll give the floor over to you.
Well, thank you, Nick, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this event. And of course, thanks to Commissioner Carr for being the featured speaker today. As Nick said, the title of this program is Closing the Digital Divide, the Future of Broadband Access. And to set up the discussion, I'm just going to read from the brief program description. The COVID-19 pandemic has brought a renewed attention to the closing of the digital divide. In response, Congress and the White House have made broadband infrastructure a top priority with several different infrastructure proposals on the table. This massive investment to connect all Americans will require significant funding. This event will explore the different options available, potential roadblocks, and the continued importance of unleashing private sector investment in today's broadband networks. In just a moment, I'm going to give Commissioner Carr a formal or at least a semi-formal introduction. But in case you somehow missed it, the key words to have in mind today are broadband, infrastructure, and digital divide, obviously all very topical now. And while the contours of what falls within the meaning of the term infrastructure has become subject to dispute, everyone seems to agree that broadband facilities are real, honest to God infrastructure. Now, to introduce Commissioner Carr, I'm going to give you the short version of his bio. You can find the complete version, of course, on the FCC's website. Brendan Carr is the senior Republican on the FCC, and he previously served as the agency's general counsel. A lot of you may not know this, but as an old timer, I'll just note that several persons who have served as both general counsel and commissioner have subsequently been appointed chairman of the agency. So that's something to look out for in the future, perhaps. Now, Commissioner Carr brings over a dozen years of private and public sector experience in communications and tech policy to his position. Before joining the agency as a staffer back in 2012, he worked as an attorney at Wiley Ryan in the firm's appellate litigation and telecom practices. After attending Georgetown University, Commissioner Carr earned his JD, magna cum laude, from the Catholic University of America's Columbus School of Law, where he served as an editor of the Catholic University Law School. So relevant to today's program, Axios, justifiably in my view, has described Commissioner Carr as, quote, the FCC's 5G crusader. He's been a leader of the FCC's work to modernize its infrastructure rules and accelerate the build-out of high-speed broadband networks. He likes to climb very tall cell phone towers around the country and shout infrastructure from the top of the tower. He has photos on his Twitter feed of him doing exactly this. So he rightly can be called the FCC's infrastructure commissioner. That's not an official position, but that's my view, really. So with that, I'm just going to remind you to put questions in the chat, and we'll get to some of those later. But now, again, I want to welcome and thank Commissioner Carr for joining us, and the floor is all yours, Commissioner.
Well, thank you so much, Randy, for that really kind introduction, and thank you for all the work that you do in the telecom space. You know, it's a complicated area, and we need big thinkers like yourself to really dig in and help policymakers figure out the right path forward. So thanks for your contributions. And thanks as well, obviously, to the Federalist Society for hosting this forum, to Nick and Dean and the whole crew. I really appreciate the chance to get to speak with you all. And as Randy and Nick said, you know, hopefully we make this interactive and happy to take some questions. But, you know, Randy, I think you really started this off the right way, which is, you know, talking about what's happened over the past year or so, obviously with, you know, COVID-19, as it hit this country, as stay-at-home recommendations spread throughout our communities, Americans virtually overnight turned to the internet to recreate their daily routines, whether it's educating kids, working remotely, accessing telehealth, or just, you know, playing, getting some distraction or entertainment by streaming content. From an internet traffic perspective, the past year was really a black swan event. You know, we saw on average something like 20 to 30% increase in internet traffic, again, virtually overnight. And that may not sound like a lot in the abstract, but if you think about it from a network perspective, when you're planning for maybe a 5% increase in traffic, a 10% increase in traffic per year, you know, a 20 to 30% increase overnight, that's like taking 2 to 3 years worth of expected traffic growth and loading it onto the network overnight. And America's infrastructure withstood that surge in demand. And that wasn't a universal principle across the globe. Our counterparts in much of Europe, in China, they saw significant internet slowdowns. There were real risks that their networks would collapse. They had regulators taking action to decrease internet usage, particularly among big streaming services offered by big tech. But our networks performed. And part of the reason why they performed is over the last 3 to 4 years, we had an unprecedented growth in internet infrastructure builds. On the wireless side alone, we had in 2016, something like 708 new cell sites go up in this country. In 2019, after the FCC updated our rules, that number jumped to over 46,000 new cell sites. And we saw the same on the wireline side. You had unprecedented levels of new fiber go in. In 2019, it was something like a 70% increase over 2016 levels. And all of this really sharpened the focus for policymakers in Washington. And I think it's fair to say there's never been as much interest and drive and determination in fully getting the job done, truly and completely bridging the digital divide. And one of the things that policymakers have seized on, Republicans and Democrats alike, is a significant additional influx of funding to get the job done. And the number has ranged from 50 to 60 billion that some have floated. 100 billion was the White House's original proposal. So, you know, we're very much talking about real dollars. So one of the questions this comes down to is, how do we pay for this influx in new spending that is going to be needed to get the job done? And it's not just an infrastructure bill, that's a big piece of it, but also making sure that low-income Americans can get online. We've launched some new programs designed to help support their purchase of services. So we need to do both of those aspects. And if you look at the funding mechanisms, up to now, there's been two leading proposals. The first approach is the way that we've been doing federally supported internet builds at the FCC for the last few decades. It's this program called the Universal Service Fund. Most people may not know about the Universal Service Fund, but almost all consumers pay into the Universal Service Fund. There is a fee, what you can refer to as a tax, that is placed on the monthly bill, whether it's wireless or wireline, And it's a tax that applies to your traditional phone service. And that tax has been increasing steadily over the years. In the last couple of years, it has been spiraling in what some have referred to as a death spiral. It's about 30% right now. So there's a 30% tax that is added on top of a portion of your traditional telephone bill. And we at the FCC collect that money. That's called the Universal Service Fund. And we use that pot of money to support internet builds in rural areas and to subsidize the purchase of low-income Americans. But again, this is not sustainable, both because that tax has been increasing. Again, it's over 30% for the first time. And the reason for that is we are taxing the services delivered essentially over the traditional telephone network to pay for the build-out of a separate, largely separate network, the internet. And this doesn't make sense. This is effectively like taxing horseshoes to pay for highways. The other approach, and frankly, if we were to try to support the additional $60 or $100 billion in broadband spending that Congress and the White House are looking at through this current mechanism, it would, you know, push that system well past collapse. So we need something new. Another leading idea, a second leading idea that some have put out there is a direct appropriation from Congress. And I think that has some advantages over the status quo mechanism, but it also has its own downsides. There's an unpredictability that comes with congressional funding efforts. There is growing concern right now about national debt. Ultimately, putting on the government's credit card, you know, that money doesn't come out of thin air. It ultimately will get passed through to Americans in one form or the other. We're going to be on the hook for that. So what I've thrown out there is a third idea, which is we should look to the revenues that big tech, broadly defined, generates from delivering their services over the network, and they should start paying a fair share for this universal service effort or towards these broader initiatives that Congress is looking at, these $60 or $100 billion new spending. They should be paying a fair share of that as well. Today, that current system, that 30% tax, is borne basically 100% by end user consumers. And this is a marked departure from sort of the historic network compact that we lived under which the communications networks in this country have traditionally been built. You know, back in the day, the businesses that benefited the most from the traditional telephone network were, you know, enterprise businesses, and they paid, you know, a disproportionate or the lion's share of the costs through 1-800 services, through long distance charges, and the end user consumer bore relatively less of the expense of maintaining that then traditional telephone network. Well, flash forward to today, and the businesses that are benefiting from these networks are Microsoft, Google, Amazon, it's big tech. And yet they are paying essentially zero into the Universal Service Fund. So there's been a slow but steady departure from the traditional norm that the businesses that benefit pay. And there's been an increasing burden, an unsustainable burden, placed on the end user consumer. And so I have put forward an idea that would say, let's replace that 30% tax that goes right on your monthly bill and look to the revenues of big tech. And there are certain revenue streams that you can look at that would not involve a direct pass-through back to the consumer. So for instance, Facebook and Google ad revenue. That is something that I think we should look at for taxing. That would not be a direct pass-through. And this is a fair approach because if you look at the amount of traffic consumed by big tech, something like 75% of all downstream traffic on rural networks is consumed just by the big streamers alone. So you're looking, you know, there at Netflix, YouTube, Amazon Prime, Disney Plus, Microsoft, companies like that. That's 75% of the traffic is just from those five entities. But something like 94% of the costs of maintaining the network, of supporting that 75% of the traffic is attributable to those big streamers. So I think asking big tech to pay a fair and equitable share so that we can have these networks that work, so we can make sure that we bridge the digital divide from an affordability perspective, makes sense. And if you go back to where I started from, you know, the Black Swan event, regulators in Europe during COVID-19 asked Netflix and other streaming services to degrade the quality of their service to take up less bandwidth because they were afraid that the continent's networks would break. We didn't have to do that in the US because we have this massive level of investment in our infrastructure. So again, I think it's fair from that perspective as well to look at big tech to pay a fair share for these networks that are performing and allowing them to realize trillions of dollars worth of benefits. So maybe I'll stop, you know, there to start, but that was sort of the idea. And I've been really pleased with the broad-based support that has been articulated already for this idea. You've got, you know, groups traditionally on the left side of the telecom policy spectrum to entities on the right that have voiced support. To be sure, big tech has not given a big bear hug to this idea, but that's to be expected. They've been working for decades, since they were just tech companies, not big tech, to make sure that they don't have to pay an equitable share for these networks that they benefit from. And some have also suggested, well, isn't this, you know, just taxing the internet, which you said we shouldn't do? And I would say, no, look, there's people that very much want to tax the internet, which is to say, when you get your monthly bill, whether it's wireless or wireline, there's traditionally two components. There's the voice service component, which may comprise, depending on the person, 15 to 30% of your bill. And then there's the data component, which may be, again, you know, up to 70% or whatever of your bill. My proposal is not that we should shift the tax from the voice portion, the 15 or 30% portion of your bill, to the 70% of your bill. My proposal is we should get that tax off of your bill entirely and move it towards big tech's revenue. So again, you can do the current model, which is tax telephone service to pay for the internet, which is not sustainable. You can go to an appropriation, which I articulated is better, but has some downsides. You can tax the internet, which I haven't proposed because it would operate in a regressive way that would just make service unaffordable at a time when we're trying to get more people, including low-income people, online. Or you could look to big tech revenues, this third or fourth idea, depending on how you rank it. And again, the current operation is regressive because it hits actually older Americans disproportionately so compared to others.
Brendan, maybe I'll jump in here, and again, I'll invite any attendees to put questions in the chat if they have them, but maybe I can offer a couple reactions and ask a question or two. And my first reaction is that, you know, if nothing else, and I think there is something else, but I commend you for, you know, putting the idea out front and having a discussion about it, and I think even hopefully forcing a discussion about it, because the reality is that this tax, and it is a tax, of course the FCC doesn't call it a tax.
You know, yeah, legally we don't call it a tax. I use the word colloquially, yeah.
For sure, it is a tax, as the economists would look at it. But, you know, I've got in my drawer a sheet of paper, Brendan, that tracks this contribution for those that don't know changes each quarter. And I've got a chart, Brendan, that goes back to 2000 that shows the increase. And in 2000, it was something I think 5 or 6% at that time. I don't have it right in front of me. But as you say, now it's, I think that most recently it was up to 33%. And it's always been surprising to me that more you know, more consumers really haven't been up in arms about it, but it is sort of buried, as we said, in your telephone bill. But it does. It's a regressive type of tax, and you know, it does have an effect. One thing I will say, and maybe this is not original with you, but I haven't heard it said before. Heard you say it when you compared the the tax to taxing horseshoes to pay for highways. I thought that was a great line, and you should patent it if it's not already patented. It's good. But let me ask you this. I think I may know the answer, but I want to clarify it. In order to implement this idea that you're talking about of requiring big tech to pay, this would require a congressional action, right? You're looking for, you're looking for Congress to take some action, or is this something that you're suggesting the FCC could do itself?
Well, yes and no to that question, and I'll give a longer answer. You know, you mentioned how, you know, this contribution factor, the percent tax, has increased. Ironically, the very first day that I worked as a lawyer at a law firm back in 2005, the very first project that I was given was to track the changes in the USF contribution factor, because it'd been going from about 5 or 6% to 7%. And there was concern about that, you know, the jump from 5 to 7% being unsustainable. And flash forward to today, as you noted, we've hit 33% recently. You also talked about, you know, how I think there's growing consensus that the status quo is broken, but there's been very few ideas articulated for paths forward, because no matter which way you go, you know, there's going to be interest groups or stakeholders that aren't happy with the idea that you put forward. So, you know, I've tried to tackle this in a way that puts a what I view as a common sense answer out there for people to chew on. In terms of authority, there's really two pieces of this. There's a portion of my idea that could be implemented immediately by the FCC without the need for additional congressional authority. So to include revenues in the contribution base, as we talk about it, is not limited. For instance, we have had VoIP and other services pay in.
Brandon, excuse me, you broke up, at least for me, froze for a minute, a few seconds. Maybe just okay. Go back two or three sentences and see whether you can restate that. So if others missed what you were saying, they can catch it.
So my name is Brendan Carr. I'm one of the commissioners. No, I won't start that far back.
No.
So in terms of the legal authority, you know, there's two pieces of this. We do not need to reclassify or classify any service as a Title II service in order to go down this path. So, for instance, we have long assessed VoIP, which we've not classified as a Title II service, and gone after VoIP revenues to contribute to universal service. So this has nothing to do with, you know, a Title I or Title II classification per se. The second piece of it is there are portions of the revenues that I'm talking about that I think today under the FCC statute, we could include as revenues that would contribute in. So for instance, there's, you know, transport like cloud services, you know, maybe the voice component, for instance, of Microsoft's Xbox service. So I think there are things that big tech does today that we could assess under the current definitions that we have in the statute in 254. But to fully implement the idea that I'm talking about, I would agree with you that we would need additional authority from Congress. And there's several specific concrete steps they could do, they could take to do that. So it's a yes and no. There's some initial steps we could take right now, but yes, in the main, to get at all the revenues that I think we should, that would take some reform from Congress.
Well, I noticed that Acting Chairwoman Rosenworcel, I believe I saw that she said something that at least was not dismissive of your and maybe it was even in the direction of saying it's worth thinking about it. Is that right? And have you gotten any reaction from the other commissioners to your proposal?
Yeah, I think she's given a couple interviews where she says it's an intriguing idea. And I'll take it. I think this is something that is, you know, worthy of discussion. If there's other ideas out there, let's get them on the table. But I think, you know, now is the point at which we need to start getting pretty concrete, pretty specific with the ideas. I've seen some of the trade groups representing big tech that they've put out some statements saying that, you know, we shouldn't punish innovative companies, and that they would hope the FCC would go forward with a common sense solution. I guess I would say, I think this is a common sense solution. And two, I don't think this is punishing innovation to ask big tech to meet the same obligations that everyday consumers meet. So I would hope that we're getting some support. Like I said earlier, there's been a pretty broad coalition from the left to the right that has expressed either, you know, interest in this particular idea or at least interest in exploring the idea.
Well, again, I think it's commendable that you put it on the table. And, you know, I guess as a footnote, we, you know, probably could say that when it comes to big tech on various issues, not only this one, but some of the other ones that we talk about sometimes, there are coalitions on the right and left that seem to come together. Well, if there are no other questions Commissioner Carr's proposal right now, I think there's a question in the chat that actually would be a segue to, I think, talking about some of the other issues and items before the FCC, you know, whether it's spectrum or removing other barriers to infrastructure that are relevant to this whole discussion about closing the digital divide and that we could talk about. But I never like to ignore a question if we can. So Commissioner Carr, if you can, I don't know whether you can see that, but there's, I think without getting the gist of the whole thing, I'll just read the last part of it because, the questioner, she refers to it as long-winded, but I wouldn't say that. I think all questions are good. But the bottom line is she's asking if Eastport up in Maine is on the FCC's radar for improving broadband access. And Eastport, as we all know, is an incredible place. Any chance the FCC is working on broadband issues in down East Maine? Also, the fact that Eastport is so close to Canada a roadblock for expanding broadband access. So maybe there's a way I know that comes with one particular community in one place, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but maybe you can take that and use it as a segue into the broader discussion about what the FCC is doing on infrastructure and expanding access.
Yeah, we've made a lot of progress over the last 3 or 4 years in bridging the digital divide. But the reality is, if your particular community is one community away from one that's gotten new high-speed service, all of this data about the progress we're making nationally is basically meaningless to you. And so nobody is flying the mission accomplished flag at this point. We've still got the work cut out. There are, depending on the definitions you use, millions of Americans that still don't have an adequate high-speed connection. You know, one of the very fundamental things we have to do at this point to target this funding in the right place is to complete our broadband mapping process. We started this during the last administration, but had a problem and a lack of funding to complete those maps. So thankfully, Congress solved that problem earlier in the year, and now it's on us to move with dispatch. And these maps will tell us in a much more granular, specific way where there's service, where there's not. And as we engage in these additional funding efforts, we can then target it to the truly unserved areas. Because I think the last thing we need at this point is spending, you know, scarce federal dollars overbuilding communities that already have high-speed service, or effectively gold-plating communities that have high-speed service but want even faster future-proof service. I think our priority has to be the communities that have 0 megabits per second, not the ones that have, you know, 50 or 80 megabits per second. So there's work ahead for us to do. We've got a number of spectrum auctions that we need to get going on, including this year. I've laid out some very specific ideas for spectrum we need to get moving on this year, next year, and after that. And then infrastructure ideas as well. I mean, there's a lot of interest in Congress in spending money, but unless we reform our permitting part of infrastructure, which we did a lot of at the FCC in the last couple of years, you know, pouring more money is just like jumping on the gas and the brakes at the same time. So you've got to pair more funding with, you know, targeting it to areas based on maps, with making sure that those funds actually go into the ground connecting communities, not just into, you know, red tape or the coffers of local governments.
What's the status, Commissioner Carr, of the litigation? I know you were a leader in the FCC's proceedings having to do with removing the barriers having to do with permitting processes and excessive fees at the local level. And, you know, that was a long-running proceeding that you took the lead on. I think that there, it's still being challenged. I know there was a court victory, at least on one of the proceedings in the appeals court. But just bring us up to date on your understanding of where all that stands in terms of being settled or not.
Yeah, we issued 4, 5, or 6, depending on how you slice it, different decisions that modernize our infrastructure rules. We looked at environmental historic preservation rules that were just outdated, particularly when it comes to the build out of small cells. We looked at some of the outlier fees that state and local governments were imposing, including some unreasonable delays on approval requests. We looked at expediting the swapping out of utility poles, adding new equipment through what we call the Section 6409 process. And some of those are working their way through the appellate process right now. For instance, the decision we did on state and local fees was affirmed by the Ninth Circuit. And some of the big cities that had been charging exorbitant monopoly rents to approve this infrastructure appealed that to the Supreme Court. The FCC and DOJ recently opposed that cert request, arguing that the Ninth Circuit got it right. Some of the other decisions that we issued are in various states of appeals in the Court of Appeals. This is typical. I've been doing this for a long time. The Republican and Democrat administrations alike. And anytime that you issue a decision that's going to expedite infrastructure builds, odds are you're going to catch an appeal somewhere. So hopefully those appeals will continue to play out. And in the main, those tend to be decided in the FCC's favor, both because of the record we establish and the way that these, reviews from the courts of appeal operate. So hopefully there won't be any backsliding on that. Again, the focus is on 5G. The focus is on connecting the unconnected. The focus with COVID-19 is how do we further narrow and close that digital divide? You can't do that by, bringing back red tape and slowing down internet bills.
I want to ask you about an aspect of President Biden's infrastructure plan that has received a lot of attention. I mean, there several aspects that have been subject to critique and discussion, but let's start with this one. There seems to be a definite tilt in his proposal towards favoring municipal broadband system networks and co-ops and not-for-profit type of entities in terms of the funding that would be directed towards them and maybe other ways as well. I know that's something that I have a concern about and express some views, but what's your reactions to that part of the Biden plan to build out infrastructure? And I mean, when is it appropriate, or is it, just give us your reaction to that part of his proposal?
Well, there's a lot, obviously, that the state and local governments can do to help accelerate, the build out of internet infrastructure. And in terms of them participating in what I would call a passive infrastructure sense, which means, laying conduit that the internet providers can use, steps like that, I think that can go a long way. The Biden plan leans very, very heavily on municipal broadband as a solution for bridging the digital divide. And, the reality is the history of municipal broadband efforts is, I think if you're being fair, it's a mixed story at best. And there's studies that show that, there aren't any economies of scale that come from a municipality doing it versus a private sector. There are concerns about, the performance of those networks. And, I was down in North Carolina at a small town that built their own municipal network. And I was talking to the city officials and they said, look, we're not in the business of, selling a competitive commercial product. We don't do that very well. And once we build this network, we really didn't know what to do with it, how to use it, how to market it, how to get people online. It's a different thing than running a sewer system or a traditional utility. And so I think there's been a lot of cases like that where it hasn't panned out as successfully as the backers wanted. So I think that's one aspect of the Biden plan that that is not a great feature. The other portion of it that I've talked about is what appears to be a preference for a single technology, which is fiber. Fiber is and should continue to be the lion's share in terms of the technology that we use for building America's internet infrastructure, but it shouldn't be the exclusive technology. There are places where it makes a lot more sense to do fixed wireless or other types of technologies, because it's not purely a question of can you get fiber today versus can you get fixed wireless today, and purely a question of cost, because there is a cost delta there. It's also a question of time as well. You know, you can get a fixed wireless network built to your house in, you know, days versus it taking potentially years to get built out of fiber. So yeah, we need to have a thumb on the scale for fiber as a general matter. That's what we do in our auctions. But it shouldn't be a one technology solution.
Commissioner Carr, when we introduced the program today and talked about the digital divide, we referred to the part of it that has to do with deployment and trying to build out networks ubiquitously. But we also referred to the fact that adoption is part of the equation. And obviously, I know you, that's part of what you were talking about earlier there, but it is such an important part of this whole thing. I mean, just to put a point on that, because I don't want our audience to think it's all deployment and adoption's not important. Are there other things that you didn't say that relate to adoption at all that are relevant, or you know if you just want to add anything there?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously these are two components of the digital divide, which is access and affordability, and we are, you know, tackling you know, both components of that head on. You know, we have stood up at the FCC, you know, a $3.2 billion emergency broadband benefit program. We have stood up a $7 billion program to get students connected. And so we are now launching and engaging in unprecedented efforts, you know, not just what we've done in the last couple of years on infrastructure builds and on affordability, but we've now got this new tranche of funding from Congress that we're getting out there. So we need to continue down both tracks.
All right. Okay. I did get a question posed to me going back to the original discussion about the contributions from big tech and in order to broaden the base there. And, you know, honestly, I'm not sure at this point the extent to which you have done further fleshing out of your proposal or not. But let me ask you the question here. When you talk about big tech and requiring them to pay their fair share, have you discussed how you define those that would be included in your proposal? I mean, I know, for example, when Senator Wicker just put out a bill for another purpose, and he talked about large platforms and small platforms and had a measure for doing that based on revenue and another wrinkle. But the question is, do you have anything further at this point to say, or are you planning to do that?
Yeah, there's several specific ways you could implement this idea. In broad brush strokes, the cut I would make would be at two or three levels. One is, I think if the entity, you know, is benefiting in terms of their revenue streams sufficiently, based on a sufficient nexus to America's high-speed networks. And then two, if there is, you know, above a certain threshold of size. So a sufficient nexus to the high-speed networks benefiting their business case, and above a certain size. Those are two cuts I would make. In the op-ed, I laid out different ways that you could do this. You know, for instance, you know, one component could be looking at the big streamers. So YouTube, Netflix, Amazon Prime, a portion of those revenues. I think it's very clear that that would pass my test in terms of being benefiting sufficiently from the network and being above a certain size. I've also tossed out the idea that it perhaps could be, you know, the Apple App Store. It could be the iPhone. You know, if you look at, you know, why does this thing have value? Why is, you know, why are they generating, you know, billions, if not trillions of dollars in revenue? It's because it rides on this network and it wouldn't have the same value without that. So I think that could be a fair game for people to look at. So you could zero in on any one of these types or categories of revenue streams, or you could construct a bill that, you know, includes in an equitable way, at least a portion, attributes at least a portion of the cost, whatever we decide that cost is in terms of $60 billion, $100 billion, and apportion it among different revenue streams that meet that high-level test.
You know, Brendan, in the old days, the commission used to issue a lot more notice of inquiries, what we call notice of inquiries at the time. You don't see those too much anymore. But as we've been talking about that, I was thinking, it seems to me that your idea would be the type of thing that would perfect for a notice of inquiry and just gather information.
I think that could make a lot of sense. Obviously, I would support an NOI seeking comment on the idea that I've been talking about. But I think, you know, that is something that we could flesh out in an NOI. And then obviously I think there's additional authority that will be needed at least to catch everything. And so the NOI can help, you know, inform those efforts to the extent that those in Congress have interest, which is a point above my pay grade to be sure. But yeah, I'm open to asking these questions and taking a look at it.
Well, maybe Chairman Rosenworcel would be receptive to that. Going back even further in history, way back, Commissioner Coelho, who served as acting chairman as well years ago, a lot of times when difficult issues would come before the commission and they would decide to just initially do an NOI, he would often vote for it by saying, well, it's only an NOI. So maybe that would be something to get this started. Okay, I'm going to read this question from my colleague at the Free State Foundation, Seth Cooper. How could I not do that?
Yeah, exactly.
Seth asked, on June 11th, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York granted an injunction barring the New York Attorney General from enforcing the state's new law requiring broadband ISPs to offer internet access services for $15 and $20 per month. What are your views on the court's decision and its reasoning?
Well, I haven't read the actual court's decision, so it's hard for me to opine on sort of the exact reason there, but you know, this comports with my view of how this case should have been decided, which is, I think, you know, federal law is fairly clear, you know, whether you look, you know, at different, you know, components of it, that price regulation, you know, of this sort by the states is not compatible with the federal regime that we have in place. So I can't speak to the exact reason of the court. I'm not sure which version of that argument they ended up going with, but this is the outcome that I would have expected that a court would have reached.
Yeah, it was just a decision, you know, the preliminary injunction with the usual caveats. But, I think in terms of the merits of the preemption issues that were raised, at least from the FCC's point of view and the broadband providers that intervened, it's promising, really, certainly bears watching going forward.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny, you know, when I have been talking about these issues in, you know, talking about the increasing desire by some to bring back so-called net neutrality regulation for ISPs, I said you really can't divorce those calls from calls for rate regulation. At the end of the day, all of these issues flow back to rate regulation. When I started making those arguments, people would say, well, no, you know, there's no real desire to do rate regulation. It's like, well, we very specifically have this New York law now that is about rate regulation or price controls. And if you look at the Biden White House proposals on broadband, at a minimum, they're playing footsie with rate regulation. At a maximum, you know, they are studying and working on a way to very specifically rate regulate. There's going to be some hurdles there, even at the federal level, to doing that. But I do think you know, the writing on the wall is there's a desire to do it. Whether they get it across the finish line politically or legally is TBD.
Yeah, I think when you write on the wall that, quote, rates are too high, close quote, which I think is a direct quote from the White House proposal, then that's a pretty good indication that you're talking about rate regulation. And, you know, I just add, whenever you suggest, when someone does suggest that there ought to be an examination of data caps, you know, to see whether they're justified or not, you know, the allocations of use, that necessarily involves really rate regulation, because you're essentially saying you're going to look at the cost involved in the network and the usage and so forth, and the traditional types of factors that you look at when you decide whether some particular aspect of a service, you know, that relates to rates is quote reasonable or not. So, you know, that's another part of it. Okay, well, in the time that's remaining, I think we've covered a lot of the infrastructure and your own proposal. I'm just going to ask you this: if your staff gets mad at me, then you can blame it on me. But you know, you have been also pretty vocal about expressing concerns with the. Let's just call it the suppression of certain speech by the big tech companies, the censorship. And obviously, I understand, I'm sure you do, that one person's, you know, view of a particular speech or whatever is another person's, you know, they have a different view of it, and we all have different views on that. But I think you share some of the concerns that I've expressed about whether there is too much censorship that's not necessary or reasonable by the big tech companies. And there's so much of that in the news these days, and there's so many proposals kicking around and so many different potential ways to address it. What are your thoughts at this point right now?
It's a good question. You know, I'm reminded, you know, if you think back, and people, Randy, like you and me can think back to the early 1970s, the New York Times, the editors of the New York Times were the ones that launched the modern day op-ed in the pages of the New York Times. They did so, I believe it was John Oakes at the time, was one of the editors of the New York Times. And he said that diversity of opinion is the lifeblood of democracy. And so they specifically launched the op-ed page because they wanted a diversity of views different than the staff reporters and editors at the New York Times to be presented in the pages of that paper. And I think we have seen a sharp departure in this country as a cultural matter from that embrace of a diversity of views. And I think we're the poorer for it. Even if you look at some of the, you know, Supreme Court's First Amendment cases from Turner all the way down, they talk about there being a government interest in the highest order in a diversity of viewpoints. And I think we're better for it as a country. You know, when we shut down even the, you know, discussion of potential origins of the coronavirus, I don't think that's a good thing for the country. When we shut down even the discussion of a story about the Hunter Biden laptop. You can't even talk about it. You know, whether you agree or disagree with the story, the idea that we can't talk about that, at least on these websites, I think is not a good thing. When you see Microsoft censoring searches for the Tiananmen Square tank man on the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, I think it is a departure from that idea that, you know, our democracy depends on diversity of views. So I think for conservatives to sit back and do nothing in the face of this very, you know, illiberal trend towards censorship is not a good thing. And you don't need to do this out of a desire to defend conservative speech. I think you can do it out of a desire to defend diversity of opinions, even ones that you disagree with. So I think that Section 230 make a lot of progress on these issues, but I also think that Section 230 reform is not sufficient. And you saw this on the Senate Commerce Committee put forward, I think is a very, sorry, I think I lost my connection there again. Senator Wicker put forward what I think is a very thoughtful way of approaching some of these big tech censorship issues. And at its core, I think there's, you know, three or four piece parts that we need to do to address this liberal trend towards censorship. One is transparency, whether it's federal or state law. I think we should step up and require a lot more transparency. The idea that, you know, a social media site can say we reserve the right to do anything for any reason is basically, you know, walking yourselves out of terms of service entirely. So I think we can require a lot more transparency and then hold these websites accountable to those public statements. Step two, I think, is some basic, what I would call non-discrimination. So, you know, you shouldn't treat, you know, the same type of speech from Democrats and Republicans differently. So if you have a term of service against, you know, violent rhetoric, you shouldn't be enforcing it against, you know, one, you know, political party versus another. I think that's a component of it. And I think you can look at what Senator Wicker is doing, what I would say is sort of is an anti-discrimination, which is looking at some of these core civil rights, public accommodation concepts of race, gender, political affiliation, and looking at ways to, you know, put guardrails in place so we don't see discrimination across those bases. Now, you've got to deal, obviously, with the case law that's out there, whether it's Turner, whether it's Pruneyard on the one hand, whether it's, you know, Miami Herald versus Tornillo or PG&E on the other hand, and work your way through those cases. But I think when you look at the unique features of these social media sites, I think there's a strong case to be made for going down this path. And I think a lot of people have reflexively looked to common carriage or public accommodation law. And in some ways that's right. I know Justice Thomas has pointed those out, but I would view those more as labels. Those are sort of examples of cases where we have imposed forms of anti-discrimination on those entities. So I don't think you need to take social media sites, sort of the square peg of a social media site, and necessarily or per se squeeze it into the, I can't remember which shape hole I was using, a square or a round hole of common carriage or public accommodation. But I do think our approach here should be informed by, you know, the cases that are relevant to those types of entities and to the anti-discrimination requirements that apply in those contexts.
You know, Commissioner, in addition to the examples you gave, it seems to me whether you're Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, or whatever, one of deplatformings or suppressions that I think bothers me and ought to be a good example of things going too far is the origin of the COVID-19 story, where I think there was enough doubt and enough debate in the scientific community and enough disagreement that it's a little difficult to see why that discussion couldn't have continued without being banned or flagged from the social media sites. You mentioned the Hunter Biden story, but I know after the election, when Jack Dorsey testified in March, I think it was, along with the other executives. Of course, the election had long been over, but he did say that Twitter had made that was just a big mistake on Twitter's part at that point. Well, look, we almost out of time, and I want to do this because there's one more question, and I want to ask it. I'm not. You'll be more of an expert than I am in terms of whether you can answer this. This is from Brett Glass, but it goes back to the discussion about the USF. And Mr. Glass says, could the ISPs to whom Big Tech connects possibly collect a fee similar to USF and then pass some of it on to the last mile ISPs in a manner similar to inter-carrier compensation?
Well, that's not the idea that I've put out there. I think, you know, some sort of explicit mechanism similar to USF is probably the right way to do it. You know, there's lots of different ways you could do this, you know, presumably, but you know, I think the best way to do this is, you know, either if you're looking at an injection of new spending, you know, the $60 to $100 billion, I think you could include a mechanism in there to get a pay for out of the big tech revenues that would benefit from that spending. Right. Or if you're looking at the sort of ongoing $9 billion that the FCC spends, I think we could get some additional authority to basically require a contribution into USF. Because again, the collection of these funds is not purely or solely about compensation for the network usage, but it also goes to these broader efforts to close the digital divide, including some of these affordability programs. So I think getting it into USF or getting Congress to use it through an offset for this $60 to $100 billion spending is the best way to do it.
Terrific. Well, look, we have covered an awful lot of ground in one hour, more than I even anticipated at the beginning. So I want to thank you, of course, first of all, for doing this, and also Commissioner Carr, thank you for your leadership on these issues. Some relate to things you've done, and others you're just helping us think about, it's all important. So thank you for that, and I'll say thanks to the Federalist Society and Nick Marr for hosting this, and I'm going to turn it back over to Nick at this point.
Thanks very much, Randy. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you, Randy, for your time, and Commissioner Carr for your time, benefit of your valuable expertise this afternoon. Also to our audience for calling in, for your great questions, great engagement. If we had any we didn't get to, we're sorry, but really good questions. Call into future events. Of course, be checking your email and our website for announcements about upcoming Zoom events like this one, where you can register, tune in, and send in your questions there. But until next time, until our next event, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.